You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko o tū tōku ingoa. Nau mai hari mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ra'apa Wednesday. I'm your host Otto and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Max. E whai aki nei coming up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March. I speak to him about the seizure of the Madleen Freedom Flotilla by Israeli Defense Forces and the Greens' calls for sanctions on Israel. We also speak about the government's new parent boost visa and the unrest in Los Angeles opposing the U.S. immigration policies and how it could impact immigration policies here in Aotearoa. For this week's Get Action, I speak to Sue Coots from Zero Waste Aotearoa about a petition calling for New Zealand to be kept incinerator-free. And I speak to Neil Curtis, a professor in the Faculty of Arts and Education at the University of Auckland, talking to us about why reclaim the wealth is a better phrase than tax the rich. Max, what you got for us today?
I speak to Bridget Carroll, a professor at the University of Auckland, to talk about the traits that make for an effective leader. And I speak to Himi Kapakingi, co-founder of the Soften Up Bro movement, to talk about Men's Mental Health Week.
Hey, aha o whakaro. I'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātui mai. Text in on 5395 or waia mai rānei. Give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Kaua e ware ware e ahia na koutou te whakarongo ki ēne kōrero. Anohi pakiheri roki roki marunga i te pai tukutuku o irirangi pōho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
The Green Party recently made renewed calls to the government to sanction Israel for its illegal occupation of Palestine following the seizure of the Madleen, a vessel that aimed to deliver food and medical aid to Gaza. The vessel, which was en route to Gaza, was intercepted in the Mediterranean by the Israeli Defense Forces before being rerouted to Israel with all those on board, among whom was Swedish activist Greta Thunberg. Earlier this week, Prime Minister Christopher Luxon and Immigration Minister Erica Stanford recently announced the Parent Boost Visa, part of the government's self-described commitment to supporting parents living overseas to visit and stay with their families here in Aotearoa. And over in the United States, 2,000 National Guard troops and 700 Marines have been deployed to the city of Los Angeles in response to protests opposing the city's recent immigration raids. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke to MP Ricardo Menendez March about all of these issues.
What is the Green Party's take on the seizure of the Madleen by the Israeli Defense Forces?
Yeah, it's completely unacceptable, and it shows that Israel isn't serious about having a solution that actually centers peace and the well-being of people in Gaza, to basically kidnap and intercept a peace flotilla whose intent was to, you know, promote peacekeeping, deliver some form of aid, and to raise awareness, just shows that Israel will basically go at any lengths to stop the international community from fighting towards peace and justice.
Do you think that the New Zealand government has issued an appropriate response to the Madeleine's seizure?
The New Zealand government has not had an adequate response to the genocide period. And I think part of the problem is that the government hasn't stepped in when we're seeing countless of people in Gaza being brutally murdered by the Israeli forces. And they're not showing a strong response at all when it comes to members of the international community effectively being kidnapped. To, for example, just issue travel bans to a handful of politicians. 2 months later after the genocide started, it shows that the government is taking baby steps when it comes to actually addressing an ongoing genocide.
Do you think that the seizure of the Madleen should be grounds for additional sanctions against Israel?
Absolutely, and the sanctions were well overdue, as well as the expulsion of the Israeli ambassador. As I've said, the government talks big game at the UN, but when it comes to using the domestic levers that we have to hold Israel to account, our government hasn't taken much action. And this is the problem, is that Israel sees itself as having leeway to continue its genocide because the international community is not taking tangible action, for example, in the forms of sanctions against the government. And Luxon and his mates have an opportunity to do this by supporting Chloe Swarbrick's bill to actually have a sanctions regime towards Israel in the same way we did it with Russia.
A UN conference focusing on the recognition of a Palestinian state will be held in New York next week. Should New Zealand be joining the countries that are planning to recognize a Palestinian state at this conference?
New Zealand should, and New Zealand doesn't even have to wait for the conference to do that very same thing. We've been pushing for quite some years, even since the previous Labour government, to have Palestine recognized. And you know, the Labour Party was too late and chose to not do it when they were in power. And I think National has an opportunity right now, particularly with a genocide continuing to unfold, that that this is a tangible step we could do to actually at least recognize Palestinian statehood, which is one first step, but that should come alongside holding Israel to account.
All right, moving on to the next topic. Prime Minister Christopher Luxon and Immigration Minister Erica Stanford recently announced the Parent Boost Visa, which is part of the government's self-described commitment to supporting parents living overseas to visit and stay with their families here in Aotearoa. As part of the visa, the parents of New Zealand citizens and residents would be allowed visits of up to 5 years, extending to 10 after applying for a second time, provided that all applicants met the eligibility requirements. So my next question is, as the immigration spokesperson for the Green Party, what's your opinion on the new Parent Boost Visa?
So we do need better solutions to reunite families and recognize that many migrant workers are sending substantive amount of money overseas and are taking a lot of leave to be with their parents, many, you know, who are aging. But the visa that was announced in the past 7 days, what it does is it basically gives allowance for those that are really, really wealthy and who have extremely healthy parents, basically, to be able to be reunited. The key issue that we have with the policy is the income and asset, basically, requirement that, for example, requires someone to have $250,000 in funds if they wanted to sponsor both parents to come to New Zealand.
So just to reiterate, is the Parent Boost Visa not robust enough to support the parents of migrants in Aotearoa?
The Parent Boost Visa basically serves only the wealthy few migrants who happen to have the necessary funds, and it leaves behind many of our migrant workers that we called essential during the pandemic, for example. It leaves out many of our construction workers, people who work in lower paid healthcare jobs that are critical to our economy and our well-being, and therefore those migrants deserve genuine pathways to be with their parents.
Erica Stanford has said that the aim of the visa is to make New Zealand attractive for migrants without adding strain to our public services. Do you think that this visa does that effectively?
If Erica was so concerned about strains on our public services, she wouldn't be slashing and cutting those very same public services. This is part of the issue, is that the government chose to actually undermine our public services, including healthcare, and at the same time then talk about how she's worried immigration could put a further strain to those very same public services, effectively spreading narratives of scapegoating migrant communities for their own very intentional gutting of public services. This is why we should invest better in our public services and have a much fair parent category visa that allows people to be reunited with their families.
Auckland barrister Nalisoni Tupou said that the financial and insurance requirements in the visa would be limiting for particularly Pasifika families. Do you agree with this?
Absolutely, because the government continues to ignore that by design many Pasifika families are in lower paid yet essential jobs. And if we are going to genuinely be creating immigration policies that recognize our place in the Pacific, but also that treat workers with the respect and dignity that they deserve, we wouldn't be having requirements that only create the conditions for high-income earners and those with, for example, $250,000 in funds to be able to apply.
And just to reiterate, what would be a more appropriate set of thresholds to include in the visa instead?
I think having an income requirement isn't fit for purpose. We should be also measuring the benefits that having families together create. For example, many of these parents would be helping with the raising of grandchildren, and we also stop a lot of money being sent overseas. Like, we shouldn't underestimate the well-being factors for families to be together. So lowering that income and fund requirement would allow, and having, for example, about, you know, we could even explore a ballot system, would actually allow for a much more just process for migrant families rather than simply benefiting the wealthy few.
All right, moving on to the last topic. Over in the United States, 2,000 National Guard troops and 700 Marines have been deployed to Los Angeles in response to protests opposing the city's recent immigration raids. Amidst the fifth day of demonstrations, as of today, the U.S. National Guard has fired rubber bullets and tear gas at demonstrators, which California officials have described as excessive force. Now, even though these events have happened beyond our shores, do you think that there are any parallels between the protests in California and the immigration policies under this current government?
Absolutely, and we've got to remember that this is coming off the back of anti-immigration rhetoric and a plan to effectively separate migrant families and deport them, causing huge harm and distress for local communities who are now living in fear and sometimes in hiding. The parallels here are twofold. One of them is the reality that many of the things that we are shocked that Trump is doing, for example, exploring removing birthright citizenship, have already been done here 20 years ago using very similar scaremongering rhetoric that wasn't founded on evidence. 20 years ago, when our government took away birthright citizenship, they couldn't actually find evidence that there was an issue with the policy to begin with. And politicians created imaginary migrants in their heads to justify the change. And this government continues to use language like how the previous government, quote, you know, opened the floodgates and talks about migrants, you know, as a burden to the economy, as opposed to recognizing our full humanity and the contributions that we bring. So we shouldn't assume that we're immune to the far-right rhetoric and policies that the Trump administration is doing here on shore.
Earlier this year, Winston Peters and Shane Jones from NZ First made comments directed towards yourself and other Green MPs of Latin American descent in Parliament, with Winston Peters telling you and Francisco Hernandez to show gratitude for being in New Zealand. Do you think that the events in California could further racist sentiment towards Latin Americans here in Aotearoa?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we've got Winston Peters, who made a career of scapegoating migrants and who's, you know, 50 years in politics. But now I think he's emboldened by the Trump's administration approach to migrant communities. And the problem is that we have a prime minister in Luxon who doesn't call it out and allows actually that anti-migrant rhetoric and often policies to basically become mainstream by nature of him not showing leadership and allowing Winston Peters to have free reins when it comes to how he talks about and directs anger and hate towards migrant communities.
And do you think that our government should be responding to the events in California and the use of force at these protests?
The most important thing that our government can do is to actually show that we can have governments that treat our migrant communities with respect and dignity, that acknowledges our contributions to Aotearoa, instead of simply creating policies that benefit the wealthy few migrants at the expense of everybody else. I think that actually would show that a different set of politics is possible, and this is exactly what we're fighting for in the Greens.
And that was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March talking to us about the seizure of the Medellin by Israeli Defense Forces, the government's new parent boost visa, and the unrest in Los Angeles in opposition to U.S. immigration policies.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
It's time to get action with Action Station Aotearoa, the segment where we chat with the people campaigning for a fairer future.
Currently, 19 out of 38 OECD countries use incineration as a form of waste management, with the process leading to a range of negative impacts such as air pollution, CO2 emissions, and respiratory illnesses. Aotearoa has luckily remained incinerator-free. However, calls have been made by some activists to strengthen New Zealand's legislation to ensure that incineration facilities are not opened up here in Aotearoa. For this week's Get Action, I spoke to Sue Kotz from Zero Waste Aotearoa to discuss a petition calling on the government to keep New Zealand incinerator-free. To begin, can you tell us about your petition and your calls to the government?
Okay, so at the moment we've got a lot of companies putting up proposals to build big incinerators to burn our rubbish in New Zealand. That's something that we don't support. We really don't see incineration as any better than landfilling. They're both disposal strategies, and that's not the solutions that we need to be putting in place for our country. What we really need to be thinking about is how we can reduce the amount of extraction, reduce the amount of environmental damage, reduce the amount of greenhouse gas emissions at the top of the supply chain. And that's really where all the answers are. So what we're doing is we're fighting against the incinerator proposals wherever they are coming up around the country. There's a big incinerator being planned for Tawamutu, and that has been going through the consent process, and next week it'll be going to a board of inquiry who are going to really think about the core issues and make a bit of a call about whether it can go ahead. It's a real crunch move for, a real crunch point for New Zealand. It's the first time we really had this big public assessment of whether or not these proposals are a good idea. And so, got the company will be going along making its pitch, and then we'll have Zero Waste Network and the Environmental Defence Society have got a joint case to oppose the incinerator. So that's really what's happening in that sort of practical side of it. What we've done is we've put out our petition saying, if you really think that incinerators are not a good next step for New Zealand, then it'd be great to have people signing up on the petition. And the petition really just has a high-level explanation of why we think incinerators aren't a good idea, why we think there's a lot of better ways we could solve our waste problems. And you can find the petition either on Action Station, or you can go to incineratorfree.nz, and you can find a link to get through the petition from there.
So why is it important for the government to eliminate the use of incinerators as a form of waste management?
Well, basically, if you think about incineration or burying rubbish, either we've got a couple of options for disposal. We can burn it or bury it. Neither of those are a good idea. We really need to be going upstream. We need to really be thinking about what we're buying, what we're using, what we're making as a society. And the best options are to change business models and to change the kinds of products that we're bringing into our economy, so that we need to extract less raw materials, use less greenhouse gas emissions at the front end, and especially if we can make things which are more durable, keep them going for longer, keep them in use for longer, then that means that we don't need to pull so much out of our environment into our economy. If we keep on using, buying, using things, throwing them away, that real linear disposal kind of model, then we just have to keep going back to the environment and drawing down another lot of stuff to use in the next round. And it really is, we can see from with all the different indicators that you look at, there's an indicator which says how circular is the global economy. It's something like 7%. So that means, it's 93% linear. 93% of the stuff we pull out of the environment just kind of goes straight through and out the other end. And if we look at all of the different impacts that we're having, whether it's things like chemicals going out into the environment through products, whether it's greenhouse gas emissions, whether it's land use change in order to be able to, from mining or different forms of extractive farming or those kinds of things, then it's really important that we tackle those things at the top rather than, go to the bottom of the cliff and put them into a different place. If you think about a big incinerator, it has a lot of negative side effects. It basically pumps out greenhouse gas emissions. If you're burning plastic, that's just the same thing as burning fossil fuel, so you end up with a lot of CO2 emissions. You end up with a lot of toxins. If you think about all of the products we have in modern economy now, they're full of chemicals. So when you burn them, you end up with a lot of dioxins and a lot of other chemicals, a lot of heavy metals as well, which we know are really harmful to humans, and they're also harmful to agriculture and horticulture industry. One of the things that you see people doing a lot is they say, oh, this is a waste-to-energy plant, so obviously that's a good thing. And what we notice with waste-to-energy sort of label is it's really a big greenwash story. It's a way of, when you're burning rubbish, you have to burn an awful lot of rubbish to get a little bit of energy out the other side. And really, if we're interested in getting it, none of that's renewable because you're really burning plastics and other things like that to be able to generate the energy. We'd be better off to invest in wind or solar, or you put our money into those much more positive solutions.
Alongside the health and environmental impacts of incinerator usage, is it economically viable to operate incinerators?
Well, not really. One of the interesting things when the companies are making their sales pitches, they'll often say, oh, we're going to bring all this money to your community. We're going to, build this massive big plant. We're going to invest, $500-700 million. And it sounds like they're doing you a real favor. We're going to create a few jobs. What actually it means is that over the next 30 years, your community is going to pay back the cost of that incinerator and every dollar it costs to run through a ton of rubbish. So you're really just These companies are looking for a long-term revenue stream from a community. And the problem with them is that if you get locked into a disposal system and you don't have good reuse or recycling or prevention things going on to give you alternatives, then your community just gets locked into paying a big bill to these guys year on year. And what we see in some of the communities in Europe, they're saying, we don't want to send our stuff to the incinerator anymore. We really want to do recycling, and we really want to get more material out and compost it. We want to, you know, we want to send less. And the long-term contracts they have with these companies mean that they can't get out. They have to keep on paying. They have to keep sending their material there. Otherwise, they face really big penalties.
Are there any other examples of legislation in other countries regarding incinerator usage that should be implemented here in Aotearoa?
Well, there's lots of people are thinking about how to deal with the situation that they've got in Europe, where a lot of countries did go to incinerators in the 2000s. They thought it would be better than landfill, but what they've discovered is that it really means that they can't meet their, now that greenhouse gas emissions and emissions reduction targets are a big thing, they've realised countries like Denmark are going, oh, crikey, now we can't meet our emissions targets because we're burning all this plastic, pumping out all this carbon, and that's problematic for us. So what they've got is managed retreat, so they're starting to shut down their incinerators, they're starting to move away from it. And we're seeing there's been a lot of work on Green New Deal and the new kind of economy work done in Europe especially through COVID time, when people are thinking, oh, this is our opportunity to have a reset. And there's been just a set of rules for governing sustainable investment. And then those rules, they've said, well, incinerator is not a thing that you could call a sustainable investment. It's something which actively harms. Shift to recycling or reuse or repair, and it really works against any move towards a circular economy. So in Europe, that's what they've been saying, that they've got a set of rules which say that investing in incineration is no longer something that public funds should be going towards. So the big funds that they've been putting in place to shift their economy into a more sustainable or more circular model, none of that can be spent on incineration. We're seeing some of the smaller countries, Wales, Scotland, those kinds of places, wanting to put a ban or a moratorium on incineration. They're saying, if we're going to invest in the future, we really want to invest in a clean future that's got, you know, positive outcomes. We want to invest at what we would say is the top of the waste hierarchy, which is prevention, reuse, recycling, repair, all the things that mean we can keep resources circulating rather than burn or bury them and have to go back looking for more.
Lastly, just to reiterate, what are the best alternatives to incinerator usage for waste management?
Well, basically, you know, a lot of people are doing it already, starting to think about slow fashion. You know, how can you have a few cool things you truly love and you really enjoy wearing rather than tapping into the whole I've got to have something new every week model? Thinking about how can you be reusing things that you have by repairing them, you know, like get your electronic gadgets fixed. Can you keep your phone for 3 or 4 years rather than get a new one every year? You know, the longer you can keep something in circulation, the fewer of them we need to make. And that really is a big win for the environment, because when we go back looking for more rare earths or those types of some of the metals that we're using in our electronics nowadays, get your tablet, make your tablet or your phone, you know, we're really destroying a lot of environmental, you know, destroying a lot of biodiversity and other environment, you know, ecosystem damage, and also the geopolitics of a lot of the places where we've got these kinds of metals which are rare. You can see it with Ukraine, you can see it with parts of Africa, where they become places that there's a lot of colonisation and people wanting to be able to get access to those resources, and so they become very ruthless, and that's not good for the people who live there.
And that was Sue Coots from Zero Waste Aotearoa talking to us about a petition calling on the government to keep New Zealand incinerator-free. If you'd like to sign this petition, you can find it on our.actionstation.org.nz under the name Keep Aotearoa Incinerator-Free. We'll be back after a quick break. Keep it on the B.
That was Get Action with Action Station Aotearoa.
BFM!
Oh, what's this bloody music?
Check out the coolest exhibition at New Zealand Maritime Museum, Hui Te Ananui a Tangaroa, Into Ocean and Ice. Go on a polar journey to Antarctica and experience five artists' interpretations of the fragile beauty of this epic landscape. From Ernest Shackleton's heroic expeditions to the climate-threatened island of South Georgia, Into Ocean and Ice, on now until August 31st, 2025. Free entry with museum admission. For more info, go to maritimemuseum.co.nz.
Challenge your senses in complete darkness with Darkfield, Seance and Flight in Aotea Square now. Step inside two custom-built shipping containers and be transported as a strange new world unfolds around you with 360-degree audio and sensory effects that will leave you questioning reality. Darkfield, Seance and Flight. On until June 15 in Aotea Square. For tickets and more info, head to aucklandlive.co.nz.
It's back! The Others Way Festival rides again, and it's about to blow your beautiful little minds. On November 29th, the party of the year returns to take over all your favourite venues. Plus, for the first time ever, they're shutting down Karangahape Road and putting up a street stage. What? Prepare yourselves for this glorious lineup that'll tear up and down Tamaki Makaurau's favourite strip.
Featuring Sharon Van Eden and the Attachment Theory.
High Dependency Unit.
Saya Gray.
The Phoenix Foundation performing Pegasus.
Witch. Anthony Tonin.
Christoph Altruinto.
Elliot and Vincent.
Jamaica Moana.
Shannon Lay.
The Bats.
Tiny Ruins as a duo.
Arahi.
Babe Tit.
Babyface Killer.
Coffin.
Crying Ivy. Plus heaps more.
95BFM presents The Other's Way. Saturday, November 29. Tickets available now from Moshtix.
It's music.
95BFM.
Broadcast to the world and podcast to your device. Go to 95BFM.com for show podcasts.
Ah! Guys, he finally asked me out. He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God! It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95BFM Drive Show. A 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday only on 95BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309-3879. The release of Jacinda Ardern's new book has sparked a renewed interest in the leadership style that was present as Prime Minister of New Zealand between 2017 and 2023. Leadership is constantly being tested and redefined. However, it was Ardern's leadership and circumstances throughout her tenure as Prime Minister that caught global attention and recognition. Professor Bridget Carroll from the University of Auckland, an expert in leadership identity and practice, her work challenges many of the ideas that we have traditionally seen as good leadership traits. She believes that now is a good time to explore what effective leadership can look like. What was it about Jacinda Ardern's leadership that led to her becoming so globally recognised?
I suppose partly it was she led during a whole succession of crises, and crisis leadership often throws up, I suppose, a figure who can either meet them or can't. And so we often get really, really interested in how leaders negotiate a crisis. Secondly, of course, she's a woman and a young woman, and those are still reasonably rare in leadership. And then thirdly, she kind of talked a different leadership talk and attributed leadership to what her title of the book calls a different kind of power. So that would be my three answers to that.
Why do you think we haven't seen many other leaders choose to lead in a similar way?
Well, I'm not sure we haven't. It's just leadership oscillates, I suppose, across the continuum. So if we think of New Zealand, Michael Joseph Savage, Norm Kirk, we have had empathetic, kind leaders before, and we will have them again. But she, I guess, sits in a time where leadership seems more instrumental, more financially perhaps driven, more about bottom lines and perhaps more masculine dominant style.
When it comes to leadership, why have attributes like empathy, emotion and morality been looked at controversially in the past?
Well, that's a really good question, because they shouldn't be. Because on a one-to-one level, those are qualities I think most of us would think are really important to have and to display. But when you kind of extrapolate that up to a government, societal, collective level, you meet conflicts and trade-offs which make those qualities pretty hard to action, I suppose. So I don't think the qualities are controversial. I think how to operationalize them, how to put them into action, how to make decisions from them are complex.
And do you think that there are any risks to leading with empathy and morality in high-pressure environments?
I would think the bigger risk is leading without those things, to be honest. The risks of leading with them are not inherent in them, but are associated with a commentary that sees those things as weak. So they are particular pitfalls for women, particularly to role model, given they are often put in a sort of binary where they're not strong leadership, they're not forceful leadership, they're not decisive leadership. That's nonsense, because of course kindness and empathy and compassion can be incredibly strong. And that's what her book, you know, the book title, they are a form of power, they're not powerless. So they've been given a bad rap, would be a simple way of putting that.
What do you think the key aspects to effective leadership are?
Well, I think they are. It is values. So she holds those as values. You can argue that when decisions are made off of them, then that they sometimes are a lesser or greater emphasised. But all leadership has to be able to execute, has to have process, has to have systems, has to go from idea or values to action. And that's often where the rubber meets the road, because those are incredibly complex. It's incredibly complex to be able to make something happen that you're putting into words or offering as a vision, and it's never a linear, straightforward journey. But without the values, leadership, you know, becomes, I think, a much more scary and lesser thing.
What kind of leadership do you think New Zealand is looking for right now?
It's a hard question about right now, but I think we are stuck in many comparable societies, which is things seem too big and too complex and too ingrained to be able to make progress from. So we see governments come and they try this and they try that, but there's never the money or the resources or the political will to do the change at a deep enough level to really make things change. So I guess what New Zealanders are looking for, I think, are relatively lovely New Zealand qualities. They want a good family life. They want a home. They want a job. They want a lifestyle. I don't think those things have changed at all. I think what's changed is it seems really hard for many to be able to achieve those things, accomplish those things. And some of the ways we used to do that don't appear to work anymore.
What can the next generation of leaders take away from Jacinda Ardern, and what should they be cautious with?
That's a really good question. I mean, I quite like the dedication in the book, which basically says, people who feel things, who worry about things, who have thin skin, we need you in leadership too. Because often we think only those who have a sort of super heroic type of performance can be leaders. And she's saying, well, that's simply not true. So they need to take that people who feel, people who empathise, people who care are exactly the ones we need to be stepping into leadership. What are the risks of that? I think it's a horrifically scary public forum for people to step out into visibility and try and do things. I think it's savage. We tear people down. And Jacinda Ardern is an example of that as well. Somehow we have to make it easier and less risky for people to step into leadership roles. It's not that they can't be unaccountable, but the barrage of abuse, of kind of violent opposition, and of course the sort of fake news, post-truth stuff, that's too formidable for many people to even contemplate.
And that was Professor Bridget Carroll on what makes for an effective leader.
The government has indicated
The Wire.
This week marks Men's Mental Health Week in Aotearoa, a time to kōrero about the challenges that many men face and to break down the stigma that still surrounds emotional well-being. For a long time, the phrase harden up has shaped the way men think about vulnerability and in turn often pushes men to bottle up emotions instead of reaching out for help. Soften Up Bro is a kaupapa founded in Te Ao Māori values, encouraging men to embrace softness, honesty and connection. To talk about men's mental health in Aotearoa and this movement, I spoke to co-founder of Soften Up Bro, Himi Kapakingi. To start off, can you talk about the Soften Up Bro movement and what inspired you to be a co-founder?
Yeah, so the inspiration, I guess, for Soften Up Bro as a kaupapa really is a personal experience between myself and the other co-founder, John Kingi. We'd both kind of gone through some personal issues at the time, and we reset this kind of agreement with each other that if we go through these things again, go through these struggles again, we're going to bring them to each other and really just be open, clear, honest about those interactions. So through that experience, we found it very liberating, we found it very helpful, and decided how can we make this useful, how can we make this generalised for all tāne. And so we came up with the idea of Soften Up Bro. And Soften Up Bro, as a name, was born out of, I guess, the antithesis or the alternative to what we often heard growing up, which was harden up. Harden up, bro, take a pill of concrete pill, all those types of things, which are all manifestations of toxic masculinity in an attempt to really disconnect tāne and men from their internal selves and internal worlds. So that's where the copepa came from, through our connection between John and I, and then certainly over its lifespan, just seeing how liberating and how helpful it has been for Tane to buy into the copepa and also to walk away with helpful skills.
Yeah, and like you said, a lot of men growing up around the world, and especially in Aotearoa, hear the phrase harden up. Why do you think that mindset is so harmful, and can you elaborate on that a little bit?
The reason why I think the ideology or the rhetoric of harden up, bro, is so unhelpful is because it denies us our true selves. It denies us a whole emotional experience that we do have as normal functioning human beings. As a contrast, we were allowed to feel happiness, allowed to feel anger, allowed to have those feelings, but apparently sadness is seen too much of a weakness and seen too much of a vulnerability. Therefore, men should not be able to feel it because you'll be taken advantage of. And so that whole idea of our emotional experiences and being denied it is very unhelpful, leads us to isolate ourselves from others and also isolate our internal experiences. Sadness is a negative feeling, and therefore I should not be having it, I should not be sharing it, and therefore I cannot really address it. And that's kind of the long-term outcomes of that approach and that mentality, is that over time, this attitude that we have towards sadness being a bad thing, a thing we should keep away and we should keep hidden, it'll find other ways to manifest itself inside someone's life, whether that be outbursts, whether that be inside anger, or whether that be at the more extreme end where people take their lives. So that's kind of what we're trying to address and what we're trying to highlight as the damaging, ongoing impact of harden up mentality.
And can you talk about some of the main goals of the Soften Up Bro movement?
Soften Up Bro is a kaupapa, and because of the different wānanga that we've hosted over time, has always been a permission-granting exercise. So we invite Tane to come in, sharing the kōrero, sharing some of the skills that we provide, so that's also very helpful. And I think it also appeals really well to men because we're so hands-on, practical, pragmatic beings. So if I can say, oh, come to this wānanga, we'll give you some tools to help you deal with your emotions or help you express your emotions, that's always worked out very well. But as a goal, it's really not Soften Up Bro that becomes the magic pill that changes it for that individual in that moment in time attending that particular wānanga. But it is a permission to say, like, this is what happens when you share your emotions in a safe space with other male who are of the same mindset. And what we've seen from that too is that Tane walk away with a newfound strength or newfound confidence to do the things that we've done inside our own wānanga and apply them to their own friend circles, which is really the change that we're looking for. It's not the 6 hours that they might be with us for the day, it's the remaining hours for the rest of their life that we're wanting to influence. So that's kind of our goal, is to bring them in, give them the permission, give them some tools, and then put them on their way to create that change for themselves and inside their whānau and friends.
When you compare it to the phrase harden up, what does softening up look like in a healthy way?
Softening up in a healthy way to me looks like, it looks like honesty. It looks like a very honest reflection on what you're experiencing. So what we typically see with Tane is that because an experience, say it's labeled as an emotional experience, we just put the label harden up on it, or the attitude harden up on it, we just pack it away quite quickly. But a softening up for me looks like a little bit of introspection. It looks like a little bit of going back to that experience, breaking it down into its details. What was the thing that was said that upset me? Why did that upset me? Where does that memory come from? What belief did I form from there? I think those are the things that we're really trying to touch on when we look at those experiences and softening up. Because even inside the anger that sometimes comes with that, if you really look at its core, it's usually mama, it's usually pain that's associated at its core. And so I think softening up is a little bit of softening up internally, just to like let yourself feel those feelings, let yourself express those feelings, let yourself experience them for all that they are, and then also find some time to reflect and articulate, whether that be in words or in writing, to really figure out what that is. I think that's what softening up is for us as a process and as a mindset, but it's also giving the Tane that come into these spaces the tools to also hold space for others, which has been a big part of our teachings. Is as much as we are looking for ourselves, looking to support ourselves, is how can we do that for others? How can we hold space? How can we let other men express themselves emotionally in a safe way and in a fulfilling way for that person?
Can you talk about some of the te ao Māori values and concepts that inspired the movement, and how do they play a role in supporting men's mental health?
Yeah, so John and I are both Māori, so it's probably that value, I guess. Matatau na ki te reo, Māotahi. tupu marika ki roto ki te ao Māori, no reira. Hareti mai kua, sino u wā māua kōrero ki ngā pito kōrero o roto te ao, ao Māori, engari, ko tōna taira, ko tōna ahotanga katoa, he mea i ahu mai te ao Māori. Hei, ko tētai tauira pia, i ngā wānanga kua hipa ake i tēnei kaupapa, toro atu ki etai waita mō teatea, hei tuāpapa, hei pātaka i ringa kōrero ki te wānanga. Kia tino kite ngā tāne ka haumai ki te kaupapa i te ritinga o ngā mō teatea ki te ao hurihuri nei, o te rā kia whai raupapa te haere o te wānanga, anei te upoko o te mō teatea, anei te timatanga o te wānanga, te puku o te mō teatea, te puku o te mahi, ka tai rāno ki te whiore o te mō teatea, a ko puta, ko ora, e nei tauira, e nei tama, ki te ao marama i roto i tawa wānanga tonu. So, yeah, I guess that's how I'd probably put the influence of Māori values and Māori paradigms inside our particular base of teaching and philosophy.
For men who are struggling with their mental health and don't know how to open up, can you explain what a good first step might be for them to take?
A good first step for mental health and for anyone wanting to do a little bit more work on in this space is pausing, just to pause and reflect. I'm touching back on that value of just actually reflecting on a particular experience, because we're real good at jumping to the extreme emotion, which is typically anger, but actually spending some time to understand, like, why did that upset me so much? Why was I so triggered by that particular experience or by that particular interaction? I just start there. Writing and journaling is such a helpful thing. It's such a helpful thing because it can take a lot of your thoughts, it can put them into words, and then put them into something that you can see and in a sense actually manage. So I think journaling is another good way. So to pause, to reflect, and to journal, I'd say, is probably a good start, just to understand yourself before you move to anyone else, should you need that support as well. But yeah, I do think that just taking your time just to understand yourself and your emotions, because it might be labelled as anger, but it might be frustration. It might be labelled as sadness, but it's actually grief. So just really spending some time to understand those details with things like emotion wheels, those are really helpful, just to really look at what we're experiencing and to find more clarity in such a messy, messy space at times.
And lastly, how can people get involved with Soften Up, Bro?
Oh, follow our Instagram page and follow our Facebook page. A lot of our updates, our messaging, it's all through there, and for any particular wānanga that we're attending. Actually, we do have a Hui Tāne coming up in Kaitaia, which is like a massive male mental health conference that we'll be attending and hosting workshops. So if you do have the time, you do have the resource to attend that up in the start of July, the 1st to the 3rd of July at Arangi Āniwaniwa in Kaitaia, please come through to our workshop, and we'd love to connect and love to reach out to anyone who wants to work with us as well.
And that was Himi Kapakingi on men's mental health and the Soften Up Bro movement. If you want to get involved, then make sure to follow Soften Up Bro on Instagram or Facebook. We'll be right back.
Hey yo, I never put a hand on a woman. It's porno. Well, let's have it down on a pillow on a wooden floor looking up. Them both hands on the buzzards, yeah. One star, I made a stash in the bushes. Came back like, damn, where'd I put it? Gave up, man, someone took it, should've booked it. Long list of things I could've would've, like 100 yon black. G hard, run it back. 200 yon black. G nah, took a L, yo, I'm comfy on that. Never too gumby with the stack, cause I ain't Mr. Money on tap. But I'm humble, cool, and a doof, cause of all that. Drugs, dirty money, and liquor, I cut it all back. Outside in that Patagonia, I cradle the local scene like kid and relax. Daddy's holding you, my crew tight, like a phalanx from Macedonia. Move like chariot wheels from Anatolia. I'm far from the richest Babylonian. G, I just want the power. I'm whipping the batter with Babylonian. Yeah, mon cœur, breaking my Bonaparte like Napoleon. Conquer, beat up the pussy, it's pandemonium. Used to push the note in the baggie and pack the Tonian. While they fund a war on drugs by slanging opium, get smacked off the podium, the tallest poppy in the field. Hey, I feel like Achilles, these parasites won't pop me in my heel. Might drop me for a minute, but it still won't stop me getting bills. Put up!
pay yourself first, that's or not. Gotta let your woman know her worth, that's or not. Want the treats, gotta put in the work, or not. Want the treats, gotta put in the work, or not. Or not. Pay yourself first, that's or not. Gotta let your woman know her worth, that's or not. Want the treats, gotta put in the work, or not. Want the treats, gotta put in the work, or not. Or not.
Yeah. My brother, brothers, you're still undercovers. I can tell that you're holding number five, still holding on. Pono on your sleeve, pono on your chest. Pono to the feelings when you're not at your best. But I can tell right now, I gotta say, bro, I'm really, really proud. Cause we all pretty fucked up in the same way. Don't let him in, but let him see him make him pay, eh? Fuck a color, fuck a side. Eat a wa, eat a ta, eat a ooh, eat that bono. Pay yourself first, that's. Gotta let your mans know it's worth that. Want the treats, gotta put in the work. Want the treats, gotta put in the work. Pay yourself first, that's. Gotta let your mans know it's worth that. Want the treats, gotta put in the work. Want the treats, gotta put in the work.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
No mai hoki mai anō. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Once again, if you have any thoughts on any of these pieces, text us on 5395 or call us on 309-3879. In the wake of increasing global inequality, discussions about taxing the world's wealthiest few and redistributing wealth are becoming more and more prevalent. However, the concept of wealth taxes are often stigmatized by proponents of neoliberalism, often likening taxation to a form of theft. Discussing the idea of wealth taxes and redistribution is Dr. Neil Curtis, a professor in the Faculty of Arts and Education at the University of Auckland, who says that reclaim the wealth is a better rallying cry than tax the rich. Here's that interview with Dr. Neil Curtis. To begin, why is reclaim the wealth a better phrase than tax the rich?
Well, it's two reasons, really. The word tax has been so maligned by the political right that I think it's problematic to use now in this context, because the political right has sort of reconstructed it as a form of kind of theft by the government, I think, of kind of private individuals. So rather than seeing tax as a contribution, personal and corporate contributions to a functioning society, it's seen as a form of kind of theft. So I think that's one problematic reason for it. And also, I think it doesn't sufficiently challenge the idea that what needs to be taken from the wealthy is actually wealth that was expropriated in the first place by very rich people using their money to buy politicians to influence policy decisions to construct an economy in a way that primarily benefits a very wealthy few. So it's money that was, you know, it's a redistribution of wealth. There's been a redistribution of wealth over the last 40 years from the sort of middle and lower orders towards the top. And so it's an attempt to take a small portion of that back to reclaim what has been taken. So it works in two ways. That's why I suggest we change the language.
Can you give us some examples of the impacts of tax cuts for the wealthy, specifically here in Aotearoa?
It's not necessarily the case of Aotearoa. This is a kind of universal thing, general thing across Western capitalist worlds. I mean, if you cut taxes, particularly for the wealthy, you remove money from the public purse. And the argument then is that the public purse is not sufficient enough to pay for services. So these services are then presented as unaffordable rather than socially desirable, if not socially necessary. So, I mean, this goes back to Milton Friedman under Ronald Reagan, where tax, and it's the same happening now with this so-called big, beautiful bill of Donald Trump, which is really a revolting piece of legislation. What happens is that the tax cuts for the rich work in two ways, and they know this. They've explicitly articulated this under Milton Friedman. So you give more money to the rich. In doing that, you remove it from the public purse, which means that the government then has to cut back on public services and social security, which the political right absolutely hate. So they run an ideological campaign against public services, social security, public health, because they want everything to be privatized and individualized. So the tax cut does these two things at once. It further enriches the people at the top, and then enforces their ideology on a government who is left with less money. All right, so that is generally the principle, the twofold principle. That's what is at work here.
Is trickle-down economics still being referred to frequently in discussions about wealth redistribution?
I don't think it is necessarily, because it is now so discredited. But I think the language has changed, where they talk about growth now much more than trickle-down. It's that if we're going to grow the economy, we need to give all our money to rich people, who are the people who create businesses and industries, right? But then that raises a whole set of questions about how much we can continue with the philosophy of perpetual growth on a planet with finite resources, right? Eventually, we've already hit a limit, right? We're already seeing this in the effects of climate change, where we're up against the limits of finite resources and a balanced environment, up against a desire for constant extraction, constant consumption, constant energy use, all under this philosophy of never-ending growth. So, I mean, it's whichever way you look at it, the situation we've created for ourselves is, well, it's madness, right? It's delusional. It's a fantasy. It's bizarre that we're still invested in it, but it's because very, very powerful people with lots of money are prepared to perpetuate a system that largely benefits themselves.
In your article, you've talked about the government's policies towards Te Tiriti or Waitangi as being a way to structure the economy to favor the wealthy. Can you tell us about how Te Tiriti has been a barrier to privatization and how removing its safeguards could lead to the privatization of public resources?
Yeah, well, I'm not a Te Tiriti expert. I mean, you've got better people to talk to about that. But basically, Te Tiriti protects certain resources, right? There are any changes to resource ownership or resource use invariably needs to go through iwi, as it should. And that remains a barrier to simple corporate appropriation. And we can see this with the Regulatory Standards Bill, right? It's another attempt. It's very anti-democratic. It's an attempt to get rid of regulations that, in a fully functioning democracy, would have democratic oversight and would maintain transparency and oversight within our society. What they want to create is a situation where that oversight and transparency is gone, and corporations and those who own them are beholden to nobody in terms of what they do or how they use resources. And I think that's deeply, deeply dangerous. And so Te Tiriti, as laws that inherently kind of protect services, resources and assets, also needs to be taken out. I mean, you have to remember that the bill against Te Tiriti was something of a smokescreen, because while everybody was worrying about that, the government were actually quietly going through every piece of legislation they could find and removing all references to Te Tiriti, right? Because they believe it's an impediment to their political project. So that's the importance of Te Tiriti. When our democracy is actually so weak that it's beholden to private corporations, we need something like Te Tiriti to protect us, protect society, and protect our democracy.
And lastly, would "Eat the Rich" also be an alternative slogan for "Tax the Rich"?
No, I think it's a stupid phrase. I don't see what any kind of benefit there is in using a phrase like that. I mean, it's a funny phrase, given that our society is built on consumption and we are literally eating everything metaphorically to the point where there'll be nothing left. But yeah, in terms of as a political statement, it makes absolutely no sense and it's counterintuitive, as funny as it might be.
And that was Dr. Neil Curtis from the University of Auckland talking to us about why reclaim the wealth is a better phrase than tax the rich.
That was The Wire.
Koira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki au mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. The Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, Sue Coots from Zero Waste Aotearoa, Professor Bridget Carroll from the University of Auckland, Himi Kapakingi from Soften Up Bro, and Dr. Neil Curtis from the University of Auckland. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakorongo ana. Thanks for tuning in to 95BFM. Next up is the Wednesday 1 to 4 with Bridge. Have a great day and keep it on the B.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.